Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. We're so glad you've decided to spend some time with us today. Coming up, we'll get ready for Thursday's big community celebration in Grafton, where a new and massive mural created by local hands will be unveiled. And Tom Ezern brings us intriguing stories of grass widows. But first, Dr. Brian Parman, Associate Professor and Agricultural Finance Specialist at NDSU, joins us to give a closer look at North Dakota's economic landscape with a special focus on the agriculture sector. Dr. Brian Parman, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you.
The reason I wanted to have you with us today is because there's been a lot of uncertainty in the national economy. Stock market dipped quickly below 40,000 after a jobs report that wasn't as robust, perhaps, as many economists thought it would be. Unemployment is a little bit different than many people expect, ticking up just a little bit. So we wanted to get a perspective on North Dakota's economy relative to this national noise. So if I could ask you a simple question, how is North Dakota's economic health?
You know, there's a lot of metrics that economists use to evaluate the health of economies, whether they're local, state, or national, and even global to that extent. And one of the key metrics that we like to look at right out of the gate is unemployment. I mean, unemployment's an important data point, mainly because, you know, unemployed people, you know, they're not spending money in our economy, whether it's the state of North Dakota or the U.S. as a whole, is a consumer-driven economy. You know, well over 70% of economic activity is consumer spending driven. And so if someone's unemployed or worried about becoming unemployed, you know, they typically spend less money, which can beget more unemployment because businesses are slowing down, less spending goes on, and it becomes a little bit of a self-perpetuation. And I know you mentioned those national numbers that it edged up, and that's true, but so far, the national unemployment rate is actually, by historical standards, pretty low. You know, just over 4%. When I was going to school, and we were talking about, we had this term called the natural rate of unemployment, and that was around 4.5 to 5%. That was what was considered kind of the standard.
Almost a sweet spot by some economists' view.
Exactly. Uh-huh. That basically people are looking for jobs at any one point for whatever reason, not because of a recession or anything, but just moving, finding new positions. And so that 4.5-5% was just kind of a natural. Well, we've been below that nationally for years, right? Really years, right? That edging above 4%, it also depends on your anchor point. Are you still using 4.5 or 5% as your standard, or are you using 3, 3.5, which it's been for the last, you know, several quarters going into this? But then you look at North Dakota, and our unemployment rate's actually lower than that. It's about 2%, maybe slightly over 2. So from that perspective, there really isn't a whole lot of concern about North Dakota's economy if you look at it from an unemployment perspective. That said, folks have mentioned, and people who live in North Dakota are probably mostly aware, a couple of our major industries, agriculture and energy. Agriculture right now is heading, you know, looking like a significant downturn, or at least drop in net farm incomes. So that's something that, you know, to be watching closely, that we came off of a period of record, you know, record high commodity prices, or at least record high net farm incomes and very high commodity prices. You know, in many cases, like in the case of wheat and corn, been cut in half or even less than that, while production costs have stayed high. So now looking down the road, is that downturn in agricultural incomes, net farm incomes, which is probably going to put some downward pressure on agricultural spending, is that going to have a negative impact on North Dakota's economy as a whole? I would say yes, but it remains to be seen what the magnitude is, and a lot of that's going to depend on how long we stay in this low commodity price situation throughout the state.
And that varies from day to day, from week to week, from month to month. Is there any idea how long commodity prices will stay as low as they are? And give us an example of what low means.
Well, again, going back to my original statement, that anchor point. Low, we, you know, in agricultural economics, reference it to where production costs are benchmarked. So you go back to when I was growing up on a corn and cattle farm and hogs in western Nebraska, you know, $2.15 corn per bushel was fine. That was because production costs were so much lower back then, that $2.15 you could make a living. Well, in the last 2.5 years or so, the cost of equipment has gone up, you know, 25-30% in a few years. Land prices have gone up. The cost of fertilizer has come down considerably from the peak, but it's still elevated if you look at across most products from where it was, say, 3-4 years ago. And then, you know, chemical prices have stayed elevated. So with all that said, what was a strong commodity price 6-7 years ago is not high enough today because of these production costs going up. So that's why when we say lower high, it's all benchmarked due to cost of production.
My simple understanding of commodity cost is supply and demand.
Yes.
Is it true then that the supply is just so great, we're just so good at producing a maximum amount of commodity that demand is just not there?
It is a supply side issue. So demand has stayed pretty stable for the last few years on things like corn, soybeans, and wheat. I mean, it's stabilized. So really the fluctuations come in on, obviously you've got Mother Nature who plays a role, you know, drought, those kind of things. Is it too wet to plant? Is it too hot and dry? All that other stuff affects the supply side of things. The demand side, while we do things on the margins to try to increase demand, there over a long run that demand can fluctuate quite a bit, but in the shorter run, and by shorter I mean a few years, it stays fairly stable. So when you run into a situation where you're producing a record corn crop after record corn crop, or you know, record beans after record beans, there's only so many end users of those products. Even when we talk about exports, even those countries have a limit to how much they can consume and use. And yeah, you might see an increase in usage here and there, but when you're having these increases like we've had with these the stability of outputs going on, and then the Brazilian farmers are increasing the number of crop acres that they are actually planting, and then their production is going up and up, that's kind of the situation you find yourself in, is you've got a lot of acres planted, favorable growing conditions, trend line, what we call trend line yields, which, you know, showing the increase year over year has continued to tick up even just a bit, you know, that makes a huge difference. And so we're sitting on a large supply right now in storage of these commodities, which brings prices down.
When you talk about net farm income, dig into that just a little bit more to give us an example of realistically this year, flat or down 10%. Across the state.
2022 was the highest net farm incomes on record nationally and even in North Dakota. So we had 2022 by any standard was a great year for farming. We had, yes, we had some high production costs, but we had really strong commodity prices, which, you know, swamped out any of that issue. Well, then 2023, we saw a substantial decline in commodity prices. I forget the percentage off the top of my head, but I think it was around a 26 or somewhere between 25 and 29% decline in net incomes for farmers during that period. 2024, we don't have all the information yet on what that's going to look like, because we're still in 2024 and a lot of the crop is still in the ground. So we don't know what the yields are going to be. And you know, when you talk about farmers and their crops, they don't just sell it in October when they harvest it. They may store it and sell some of the crop next July, for instance, or next May. And so with that being said, we don't know how 2024 necessarily is going to finalize. But what we do know is that right now prices are as low as they've been in many, many years. And it doesn't look like there's going to be a big upswing in prices next year, given what we're seeing with yields and our crop progress and everything looking pretty strong for harvest time. So what 2023 being down off the peak is considerable, but the expectation is 2024 is going to be considerably below that. And I've run some preliminary numbers on what we projected 2024's cost to be per acre for certain commodities, and then plugged in, you know, what cash prices are being offered out in the state. And in some cases with some of our crops, we may be potentially in the negative, and this is just on average. It could be obviously better, but it could be worse for some folks. Minus $100 an acre, minus $110, $120 an acre.
That's significant.
Yeah, it's very significant when you think about if somebody were planting 2,000 acres and you're $100 under per acre or below break even, you know, you're talking about loss of $200,000. That's so you've, you know, gone backwards $200,000. And so where is that money going to come from for the next year? Well, then you're talking about borrowing against equity that you have in land. That's assuming your lender is going to allow that to happen. And it's not the best place to be in, for sure.
How much does international events
impact commodity prices. The war in Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. Incredible agricultural country has been impacted somewhat, although obviously prices are still way down. Do international events impact commodity prices here?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the war between Russia and Ukraine was one of the things that really hit that was the uncertainty. So right away, conflicts globally, a lot of times you're going to see a big impact initially. And that's kind of what we saw happen, and that being the most recent example is there's a conflict, price goes either way up. Fertilizer, for example, was greatly impacted by this conflict because Russia, Belarus, those countries are major fertilizer exporters. And so the market's going, we don't know how this is going to shake out. So there's a risk premium built into the market because we're not sure how much export there's going to be. We know that Brazil is a major importer of fertilizer, and if they can't get it from this country because they're in the middle of a conflict, they're going to have to buy from someone else. It's going to drive global prices up. What's going to happen? Well, as time goes on, you know, and the market finally gets more comfortable with the situation and how things are, you can see those prices come down like we saw with fertilizer. And then it doesn't necessarily have to be a violent type conflict. It could be the trade dispute between the U.S. and China that occurred in 2018. And that right there, we saw soybean prices absolutely plummet when that trade dispute began, primarily because China is a major buyer of U.S. soybeans. And that impacted North Dakota even more so because we export a large share relative to the other states in the nation of our soybeans out of the Pacific Northwest over to China. So when that trade dispute happened, it affected all soybean farmers in the U.S. negatively by dropping prices because China was not buying U.S. soybeans. But it impacted North Dakota farmers even more so because of we have such a heavy reliance on exporting those soybeans out the Pacific Northwest and over to China. So what we saw was while the market price, the price you would see if you went to the Chicago Board of Trade or whatever, the spot, we call it spot price, might be universal across the country, what elevators are willing to pay for the crop, because then they have to figure out how to get it shipped and how to get it sold, might be a lot less in North Dakota than it is in, say, the state I used to work in, Mississippi, where Mississippi is what's called a grain deficit state. And so they'll actually pay more for the crop than the spot price, where in North Dakota, because we raise so much and do not have enough end use for it, it's less.
Enjoying our conversation with North Dakota State University's Dr. Brian Parman. He's an associate professor and agricultural finance specialist, trying to understand North Dakota's economy, mm-hmm. contrasting to what might be happening nationally or even internationally. You talked about employment and employment trends and the fact that North Dakota has such a significant low unemployment rate. How does that impact our economy? Is that too low?
That's a great question, actually. Is it too low? And that depends on who you ask. But, you know, first of all, I think many folks, whether you're in ag or not, have noticed businesses in Fargo, Grand Forks, wherever, have had to close up because they couldn't staff them. I mean, that's a real thing that's happened across our state. And I think everyone who might listen to this knows of an example of a business that said, we would like to stay open, but we just cannot. Or they're closed on Mondays, or they're closed on Tuesdays trying to find staffing. So the extremely low unemployment number, if you talk to business owners, is a serious issue. I mean, it's causing, again, businesses to close, wages to be driven up. You've got perhaps a lot of turnover in certain sectors, and also in agriculture. You know, for folks who aren't familiar, agricultural labor has become a very skilled and specialized job. You're operating equipment that costs $750,000 to $1 million. You're spraying chemicals on that. If you make a mistake or you apply at the wrong time, you could kill your neighbor's crop or cause real damage and problems. So you have to be trained. You have to, and so it's, you know, when I was a kid, a lot of the labor was me as a kid, you know, 15, 16 years old. Nowadays, you don't turn that over to someone like that because of all the expense and the knowledge needed to carry out the job. And so if you when you talk to a lot of business owners, whether it's small businesses or even larger businesses in North Dakota, the lack of available labor supply right now is an issue for those folks, and it remains to be seen how this is going to impact us going forward, and perhaps with growth, our business is going to make decisions on where to locate because of how low the labor supply is right now in our state.
Other factors that are impacting our economy, maybe that you've thought about, housing, the housing market. Costs are up, supply there is also short as well. Has that impacted our economy?
Absolutely. The housing market is one that's been, in North Dakota as well as nationally, is one that's been really probably, I don't want to say impacted the most by the raise in interest rates, but it's been impacted tremendously by the rise in interest rates. And what we talked about when I was given some outlooks on housing and housing affordability last year was what we called the lock-in effect, right? And bankers have mentioned that too. And if you're unfamiliar with the lock-in effect, it's that folks like myself who own a home and bought it several years ago, we all had plenty of opportunities to either refinance or initially finance at rates below 3% in many cases, 3-4%, right?
Historically low.
Historically low, by any metric. I mean, as far back as the data goes, historically low. And I would be shocked if I ever get a rate lower than the one I have right now in the rest of my life. I don't know how that's even possible. And so then, if I were looking to move or sell my home and now I'm facing 6.5, 7, 7.5% or perhaps even higher of an interest rate, that impacts the payment on my home, any new home I was going to buy, tremendously. So how do I offset that? Well, I have to convince the buyer of my new home to pay more than they would have paid had interest rates been 3.5%, because I got to take the extra additional funds, roll it into the next mortgage so that it brings that payment down comparable to what I'm paying now. Or I simply don't sell because that maybe is infeasible, which means it's locked in, which puts further restrictions on that supply. So in order to pry, so to speak, the supply out of other folks' hands, you got to pay far more than you would have had to pay 3 or 4 years ago because of where rates are sitting or have been sitting recently. And so it basically exacerbated an already shorter supply than we would like to have, this lock-in effect. And then you had the situation coming out of the COVID lockdowns where folks who were living in large multifamily units in some of the larger cities around the country, they were basically shut in, for lack of a better word, for 5, 6, 7 months and wanted to move out to a more suburban environment. So you get this bump in the demand for single family homes with a small yard or big, whatever the case may be. At the same time, then right after that, interest rates go up and you wind up people with owning homes who are locked in. So we had kind of a multifaceted situation that wound up creating this issue where housing prices continued. And the other thing is that lock-in effect has also really kind of helped keep inflation sticky, because you've got housing prices, which are included in the CPI, right? And those continue to move up because of this. And as that's the affordability of housing is another important component to what the Federal Reserve and government focuses on. And it's, you know, you've got this sort of a feedback loop of higher rates making housing prices higher, which then increases or helps maintain or keep that inflation rate higher at the same time.
And I want to go with inflation next.
Sure.
What do your projections tell you about inflation in the short term and in the long term? Are we over the hump that we have all experienced in almost every aspect of our lives? Or is inflation still going to be an issue for us here in the state?
Well, I've done I like to look at historical data a lot. I mean, not history doesn't always guide the events that are going forward, because times change and situations change and the economy changes from the last time we had an inflationary period. But at the same time, I do think there's information to be gleaned from what happened historically. And if folks who are around, and I was not, but I've studied the history of in the 70s and 80s, that was a period of inflation the likes of which we've really never seen, and we still haven't seen it. What we just experienced was nothing like that, the 80s and 70s.
My first interest rate on my home was 11.2%.
Exactly, and some people paid 20, depending on when in the 80s you took the loan out. But what happened was we had an inflationary period in the mid-70s, and the Federal Reserve did like they did here recently, and they increased the federal funds rate. And they increased it quite a bit, and eventually inflation in the 70s started coming down. So the Federal Reserve dropped the federal funds rate, interest rates came down, then inflation came roaring back far worse than it had in the previous cycle. And so then the interest rates got, that's when we went hiked up to rates, the federal funds rate of 20%, 21%. In fact, the federal funds rate at times in the 80s was higher than the interest rate, which...
Incredible.
Well, you get a bit of a limiting effect. At some point, you can raise rates so high that everybody is already priced out of the market, so you raise them even more, and what difference does it make? Because nobody's borrowing anyway. But that, I guess, is one of my... That's not lost on the current Federal Reserve. These are, you know, pretty intelligent people who know what they're doing, I believe, and that they want to prevent that situation from occurring where they raise or lower rates too soon. We get a spike in inflation, and then the cure for that is even more painful or costly than it would have been if they'd have just stayed the course that they're on right now. Because, to be quite honest, so far, we've absorbed these higher rates about as well as you could probably have expected. There's been people who've been saying we're going into recession last year and the year before that because of these rates, and it really hasn't happened yet. In fact, it's been pretty robust, and that's encouraging as an economist, saying that if and when a recession or something negative does occur, the Federal Reserve has the tools now to actually combat it. Because one of my concerns when interest rates were 3%, 2.5%, 3%, I mean, they were already so low that dropping the federal funds rate was going to probably not have as big of an impact. And one thing I want to say on interest rates, the last thing, it goes back to that anchoring point I mentioned before. What is considered a high interest rate? Well, if you go by a historical average, 6.5%, 7% is not high, actually. It isn't. It's high when you've made years of business decisions and financing and spending decisions based
3%
on
3% money or 4% money,
yeah, for you know, forever, then it seems very high. But if your anchoring point is 6%, 7%, 8%, like the historical average, or even higher, then 6.5%, 7% doesn't seem very high at all, and it's natural for people to change it. But going back to the inflation outlook, at your original question, you know, I think if the Federal Reserve stays the course, if the folks in charge continue looking at the data, you know, adjusting accordingly as they've done, and their comments suggest that that's what they're planning on doing, I think that we will see inflation continue to subside. Now, core inflation that's the inflation without food or energy, has been sticky. It's been above 3%. The Fed's target's 2, and it just pretty resistant to come down below that number. But, and I guess that's not all that surprising, though, because the closer you get to sort of your benchmark, the harder and harder it is. It's sort of like if you're studying for a test, how many hours do you have to study to get a B versus study to get an A? You know, it may be twice, three times as many hours to get the A versus a B. Well, the amount of time and evaluation and people's perceptions that need to change to get it from 6% to 4% versus 3% to 2%, it could be a lot longer to actually pull that off.
As we tie up our conversation today, what are your projections relative to North Dakota's economy in the next 5 to 10 years? Are we resilient in our state?
I think we are resilient, and there's a lot of projects floating around, development in both things like biofuels production, oil seed crushing plants, they're coming in. We've got these, you know, latest reports I have, two massive dairies actually moving into the state here fairly soon, which is going to be a great end user for a lot of those agricultural products. Business development has been fairly strong. You know, I know that North Dakota's kind of got a reputation for being a business-friendly state and welcoming to it, and we've just got to make sure that we have the available labor to actually achieve, as I said before, so, you know, some of the growth that we're looking at. But by and large, you know, the fundamentals of North Dakota right now seem pretty robust, and you know, ag downturns happen. Ag tends to be cyclical, so the situation I'm describing moving forward is not something we haven't been through before. You know, it's just how long until we're able to turn things around.
NDSU's Dr. Brian Parman, an associate professor and agricultural finance specialist with NDSU Extension. It's been a pleasure.
Yep, thank you, sir.
Coming up after the break, we'll take a look at the community celebration happening this Thursday, August 15th in Grafton. The event will feature a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a new mural, with festivities running from 4 to 6 p.m. That's after this.
North Dakota Council on the Arts, in partnership with the ND Main Street Summit, will be hosting its free biannual statewide arts convening, August 27th through the 29th in Watford City. The convening will focus on placemaking, with topics that include the Arts Across the Prairie program, attracting a workforce, asset mapping, creating vibrant communities, and strategic planning. Side trips, town walks, receptions, and many other activities are planned. Learn more about the statewide arts convening at arts.nd.gov.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. The Grafton community has been working on a stunning new mural that will soon adorn the side of the Carnegie Library. After much anticipation, they'll unveil and celebrate this vibrant addition on Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m. This project, which has been in the works for some time, reflects the community's dedication to enhancing their public spaces.
Laura Glanner and Greta McLean, they are both part of a fantastic mural that is about to appear to the public in Grafton. Laura, first, I'll welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Laura's title is the project manager of the Grafton Community Mural. And Greta, she's the lead artist and facilitator. Greta, welcome.
Thank you so much.
How did this project begin? What was the genesis of the idea?
I took a webinar that Greta had through the North Dakota Arts Council, saw the process there, and a few months later, I reached out to her and asked her if she could do this in Grafton, and she put together this wonderful proposal, and she was like, yeah, sure, here you go, try to make it happen.
Describe for me exactly what it is, because I've seen pictures of what's been happening in the last few days, and it's just beautiful. Paint the picture for our listeners.
I probably should add that we got our funding from the Grafton Community Foundation and the North Dakota Council on the Arts, as well as the Grafton Economic Development Committee. It's a pretty in-depth project. We chose 5 North Dakota artists to come and help. So that was kind of the first part of the project. And then in June, we got them together, and we actually went around to different places in the town and asked people what they would like to see on this mural.
And tell me where this mural is.
This mural is going to go up on the Carnegie Regional Library here in town.
It's a large, large brick space on that wall. So continue on.
Yes. We got the input from the community for the design, and Greta took that and ran with it and created this beautiful design for us. And we got the cohort of artists together again, what was it, August 3rd? And they started laying it out as a giant paint by numbers. Then we had 3 paint parties in the community where everybody came and painted. The first one was at the Lutheran Sunset Home, which was really amazing because we had a 3-month-old there all the way up to 102.
Wow.
People of all ages were painting. And then we had another one at the old True Value Building here in Grafton, which allowed for a bigger space. It's an old, empty building. And we had people from the Life Skills and Transition Center come, as well as we had about 115 people come through that party. And then we also had our 3rd paint party at the Grafton Farmers Market. And we had about 150 people there. And everybody of all demographics here in town, all ages, were able to come and paint.
What you're saying is someone like me with no artistic talent at all really could have helped with this project.
Yes. Yes. All you have to do is match up your numbers. So,
Greta, what did you hear when Laura talked to you and others talked to you about what Grafton wanted on their mural?
Well, first, even just before they even talked about content, it was really beautiful to hear them say, like, we're really interested. So my mural business is called Good Space Murals, and we have a training that we run that's called the Good Space Mural Method Training, where we teach artists across the country, like, how to really pair mural making and community engagement. And so I was like, I can come and just do a mural with you guys. And she was like, I think that our community really wants to invest in North Dakota artists. So we would like to host like a training. So we working with local artists has been just amazing. So first, just to hear that expressed, we heard them talk about being a farming community, their pride in the Red River Valley, what it means to be from a place like Grafton, how their memories of what Grafton has been, and then their dreams for where Grafton are going.
So as you started to put this mural together in your head and start working with the North Dakota artists, what evolved? What are we going to see?
One of the things is that we were like, oh, let's wrap the whole building. So it got a lot bigger. And basically what you see are different facets of the Grafton community, and everyone is reading with a beautiful backdrop of fields, the wildflowers and sunflowers that are here. There are sugar beets, there's potato fields. And then there are all these people that have invested in this community that are depicted.
And so when the mural also wanted to consider what Grafton will become or what its future is, how was that incorporated into the mural?
Youth that are shown. And then we also have a section where we see people that are building, that are framing out the future. And this was really inspired by all the work of the Beautification Committee, because they really are thinking forward. How can we invest in this place? How can, instead of lamenting changes in what downtown looks like, how can we think of different ways of activating our empty spaces? Also just creating different ways in which different facets of the community can come together and come.
We're enjoying our conversation with Laura Glanner. She's the project manager of the Grafton Community Mural. And Greta McLean, she's the lead artist and facilitator for the project. There will be a community celebration, Laura, coming up soon at Carnegie Regional Library where the mural is. What's going to happen?
So we are going to have all sorts of things. We'll have face painting and bingo. There's going to be a cupcake walk, bouncy house. There's going to be, I don't know if people know about these amazing blue blocks, but we had some loaned to us from the Children's Museum in Grand Forks. And then our kids' play space bought some as well. So there's going to be these really fun blue blocks that kids can play with. There's also going to be the mural introduction and narrative going on at 5:30. So
Laura, I'll ask you and Greta this question. Laura, you can have a crack at it first, but why is it important to have beautiful art in public spaces like this project has become?
Art helps with, I think, our mental health. And just, you know, when you're going down the street and you see a piece of beautiful artwork, it can just make you smile. And I think this type of art with the community involvement, I think it has brought another level of connection to people. So when people go down and see this mural, they're going to think of like, wow, I helped with that, or that's my grandpa on there, or they'll have a real connection with it, and they can show like it can be a generational thing where they share it with
I painted that right there.
Exactly.
Greta, when you travel around the country, is it the same feeling? Is it different in different parts of the country for people who appreciate public art like this?
No, I think that public art is used in different ways across the country. But in general, this need to connect and find new ways to be in community is urgent, kind of no matter where I've been, like everywhere I've been across the country. So it's beautiful to be working like murals in the rural and be like, how do we use these when we're, you know, like, can we, this idea of, you know, having these public paint parties, doing a mural in an indirect, using an indirect technique so that pieces of it can be fabricated in different locations or during the winter or during, you know, like, or at night or after harvest or whatever and put up, I think really speaks to like what this community or how this community works already and then can kind of fit in to start to address that need of how do we connect with each other, that we are seeking to connect. And the public art is such a beautiful and kind of sneaky way to, like, you think what you're doing is painting or you're working on a project or you're helping your friend or you're, you know, Laura invited me, so I'm going to go. But really what you end up doing is being part of something bigger than yourself, and you get to point to something and say, hey, I was part of that. And somebody maybe that you've never talked to was also part of that. And now you are connected. It doesn't have to be even deeper than that. It starts to shift and kind of ripple out on how we are in community.
Building up a social fabric of a community for sure.
100%.
So give me the details. How big is this and how much paint did you use? What kind of paint and what did you paint it on?
So we are using the Polytab technique. It is an indirect mural technique that was developed in the early 90s in Philadelphia by the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program. And so the whole mural is painted on a synthetic, lightweight fabric that's called Polytab. It's actually in the garment industry interfacing. It's like what's used in your cuffs and your collars. So we just get it in large bolts, large rolls. That's what we map the whole mural out. It's kind of like hand-painted wallpaper. So we map it all out. We project it and make it a big old paint by number. So this one, all of the sheets are 5x5, more or less, 5x5 feet. And there were 80 plus sheets that we had to paint.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, 25 times 80, whatever that is, that's the square footage. It's about that. It's like 1,800 square feet, more or less, because some pieces are a little smaller. But then we painted with our base coat was a Sherwin-Williams paint. And then now we're using a Nova color on top. And the idea is that we want our colors to be really bright and vibrant and to reflect this community and its vibrance. And that maybe some of that vibrance hasn't been shown on the walls, on the buildings, but now it's our chance. So we really want to pop it forward. And then using this technique and using this kind of high quality product, this mural should last at least 20 years. So it's really like a big investment in that social fabric that you talked about, what we want to build here.
It leads to my next question. How do you maintain a mural like this? Is there some work that folks down the road are going to need to do to make sure that this remains as beautiful as it is today?
A mural like this is way less maintenance than a mural that is painted directly on the wall. They will not chip. Like the paint acts differently because it is adhered first to this canvas and then put up. So there won't be chipping. I think just like any other wall after our winters, and if there are spaces, where you put any salt down or any kind of work done in the winter or mud on it, it can just be kind of washed, especially like on the bottom section. If we want to do that, just like all of our walls, right? We don't tend to wash our exterior walls, but now this one's going to be extra special. Just kind of watch it. It should last without any maintenance, really. But if there is any moments where things, like a snowblower runs into it or something, it might tear a little bit the fabric in certain areas, just like it would chip paint when it does that. And we're using a heavy body acrylic gel to put up the piece, to adhere the piece to the wall. So you can just take a little bit of that gel, smear it on the spot, and touch up that little spot with a little bit of paint, and this thing should last even longer than 20 years.
Where's your next project, Greta? Where are you going after this?
I have a project actually in Rochester, Minnesota is my next stop, and in Morganton, North Carolina. So those are my last two murals of the season are in those two steps.
Laura, will there be another mural painted someday in Grafton on another building, perhaps?
I hope so. This is actually our second mural that we've done. We also did one with Bo Bakken from Halak. He painted the first mural that we did in town. So this is our second, and we are definitely hoping for a third and maybe even more.
Laura, obviously, this is a celebration that's open to absolutely everyone. Mm-hmm. And of course, the weather's going to cooperate with you.
Oh, I hope so. I also forgot to mention that there's going to be the food truck is going to park that we our new food truck park is going to be open with Lynn's Tex-Mex and Hank's Ice Cream. So we'll have all sorts of food available there as well for purchase.
Are there other projects on the horizon, Laura, that you want to talk about a little bit with Grafton and its and the surrounding community?
Another project that the beautification committee is really close to finishing and people have already been using it is the Harmony Gardens, which is a musical garden in Lestico Park. And it has a variety of outdoor musical equipment that people can come and use. And that's been a really special project as well that we have gotten together faster than we thought was possible. So,
well, congratulations on the mural. It'll be really exciting for me to see it when it's fully done. I've got a sneak peek here today, and boy, does it look wonderful. So congratulations. Laura Glanner, she's the project manager.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Laura, of the Grafton Community Mural, and Greta McLean, she's the lead artist and facilitator. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Whether you're a sustaining member, or you give annually, or you've made additional contributions to Prairie Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Prairie Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
Tom Ezern's Plains Folk essay discusses the role and perception of grass widows, women whose husbands were absent, divorced, or missing in the late 19th and early 20th century in prairie communities. These women were often subjects of humor, suspicion, or desire in local stories, with newspapers frequently portraying them in a negative light, ignoring the equal responsibility of their male counterparts.
The local press of Castleton reported in 1883 that a Broom Brigade of ladies assembled in town to march on the residence of a grass widow with the expectation of finding their husbands. They discovered, however, that their wayward mates were all occupied at a poker game in the saloon. I've been talking about the use of the phrase grass widow in prairie communities of the late 19th century and early 20th. Also, the awkward place of grass widows in such communities. A grass widow was a woman who had, or was presumed to have, a husband, but he was absent, either divorced or just missing. A woman on her own, often the object of desire, humor, or suspicion. I suspect the story of the Castleton Broom Brigade is apocryphal, but it is illustrative. Others are more unsavory, portraying the grass widow as a temptress. Certain small-town newspaper editors, indeed, took a suspiciously intent interest in the activities of local grass widows. One joke went, a grass widow and a rake usually get on well together. In 1882, however, the Fargo Press reported a buxom grass widow had drawn a nice young man of previously irreproachable reputation, quite prominent in church circles, into a relationship of, it said, fervid intimacy, visiting him at unseemly hours, remaining all night. When pranksters secured his door from the outside, the grass widow dove out a window. A story from Sanborn in 1887 made sport both of bachelors and grass widows. A fellow fell violently in love with a pretty grass widow, it was reported, and while exercising his passions on a couch, was alarmed to hear cracking noises. He feared he had fractured the lady's ribs, but it turned out he had merely busted her corset stays. In 1902, a livering man from Jamestown disappeared from town the same day as a local grass widow, leading the town's editor to suggest they trot a fast heat together. A few years later came a pathetic story from Braddock concerning a young man named Robert Froude. He took up with the grass widow, unnamed, who, the press reported, helped him drive a bunch of August Bence's cattle to Bismarck for sale. Although the implication was the grass widow had brought young Froude to grief, it was he who was sentenced to 2.5 years in the state penitentiary. Same year, 1909, same county, we read a dashing Hazleton businessman showed up at the party of guests at what was supposed to be his wedding to a local grass widow, only to find the lady in question, after first appearing to prepare for the nuptials and perhaps gathering together some gifts, had taken the auto route with a better-looking man. Rarely were press reports of the doings of grass widows gracious. The Pembina Pioneer Press in 1885 reported that the grass widows of the town had gathered to enjoy an oyster supper. This was reported with a straight face as a matter of women offering one another social support. Newspapers reported only the shady or suspicious doings of grass widows because in prairie communities, grass widows, even more than male bachelors, were regarded as a social problem. The best they could hope for was a don't ask, don't tell status. Usually people told. They told jokes, which might be relatively benign. Frequently, they blamed grass widows for misbehavior that, it must be noted, also involved male partners. This was a fact of life in prairie communities. The stories of the grass widows, in their own terms, went untold.
That was our longtime friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 13th. John Conrad Berkey is probably the best-known science fiction artist on the planet. Even if you don't know his name, and you probably don't, you know his work. His artwork appears on the covers of books, calendars, and movie posters. His bold vision defines science fiction art. Berkey was born in Edgeley, North Dakota, on this date, in 1932. His family moved around, and as a child, he lived in South Dakota, Montana, and Minnesota. He studied at the Minneapolis School of Art. He spent the rest of his life as an artist. He worked for a St. Paul advertising agency, where he produced as many as 70 calendar illustrations a year. In contrast with his later success as a science fiction artist, his work featured historical scenes of pioneers, the early railroad, and Great Plains agriculture. After 8 years with the agency, he struck out on his own and found success as a freelance artist, producing work for a variety of magazines, including Popular Mechanics, TV Guide, and National Geographic. Berkey came to the attention of science fiction fans with his cover art for a Ballantine book series. He designed covers for books by some of the biggest science fiction names, including Isaac Asimov, Philip K. Dick, and Robert Heinlein. In the 1960s, NASA commissioned Berkey to produce artwork depicting the Apollo space program Skylab and the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. His science fiction work brought him to the attention of the movie world. He created the artwork for The Towering Inferno in 1974. That was followed by artwork for blockbuster movies including King Kong, Superman 3, and Dune. His most famous movie work was for Star Wars. The artwork influenced the design of many of the movie's elements, including the Death Star and the Empire's Star Destroyers. His creation of the iconic Star Wars poster was the first look the public got at the new movie, increasing anticipation of the film's release. During his busy career, Berkey also found time to design 15 postage stamps. In 1999, he received the Spectrum Award for Grand Master, recognizing his impressive body of work. He was inducted to the Society of Illustrators Hall of Fame in 2004. In 2007, Excelsior, Minnesota honored him with John Berkey Day. Berkey died in April 2008 at his home in Excelsior. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Palestinian American Sammy Obaid is a former math teacher turned stand-up comic, and he tells jokes about things that aren't typically considered funny, like the Israel-Gaza war.
Comedy comes from tension, basically. And the more tension there is, there's more room for jokes.
How and why Obey tries to bring levity to this violent subject on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public. And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are grateful you have spent time with us. Tomorrow, Rick Guillen will dive into Lake Cuisine in his latest edition of Prairie Plates, guaranteed to make you hungry. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow on Main Street.